Chapter 3. How Famous Speakers Prepared Their Addresses. There's a vast difference between having a carload of miscellaneous facts sloshing around loose in your head and getting all mixed up in transit, and carrying the same assortment properly boxed and crated for convenient handling and immediate delivery. Lorimer, from Letters from a Self-Made Merchant to His Son at College. The power to grasp the essential features of problems is the great differentiation between the educated and the non-educated man. Undoubtedly, the greatest advance to be gained from a college education is the acquisition of a disciplined mind. John Greer Hibben, President of Princeton University. What is it that first strikes us, and strikes us at once, in a man of education, and which, among educated men, so instantly distinguishes the man of superior mind? The true cause of the impression made upon us is that his mind is methodical. Samuel Taylor Coleridge. I never give 'em hell. I just tell the truth, and they think it's hell. Harry S. Truman. I was present once at a luncheon of the New York Rotary Club when the principal speaker was a prominent government official. The high position that he occupied gave him prestige, and we were looking forward with pleasure to hearing him. He had promised to tell us about the activities of his own department, and it was one in which almost every person in the room was interested. He knew his subject thoroughly, knew far more about it than he could possibly use, but he had not planned his speech. He had not selected his material. He had not arranged it in orderly fashion. Nevertheless, with a courage born of inexperience, he plunged heedlessly, blindly into his speech. He did not know where he was going, but he was on his way. His mind was, in short, a mere hodgepodge, and so was the mental feast he served us. He brought on the ice cream first, and then placed the soup before us. Fish and nuts came next, and on top of that, there was something that seemed to be a mixture of soup and ice cream and good red herring. I have never, anywhere or at any time, seen a speaker so utterly confused. He had been trying to talk impromptu, but in desperation now he drew a bundle of notes out of his pocket, confessing that his secretary had compiled them for him, and no one questioned the veracity of his assertion. The notes themselves evidently had no more order than a flat car full of scrap iron. He fumbled through them nervously, glancing from one page to another, trying to orient himself, trying to find a way out of the wilderness, and he attempted to talk as he did so. It was impossible. He apologized and, calling for water, took a drink with a trembling hand, uttered a few more scattering sentences, repeated himself, dug into his notes again. Minute by minute he grew more helpless, more lost, more bewildered, more embarrassed. Nervous perspiration stood out on his forehead, and his handkerchief shook as he wiped it away. We in the audience sat watching the fiasco, our sympathies stirred, our feelings harrowed. We suffered positive and vicarious embarrassment. But with more doggedness than discretion, the speaker continued, floundering, studying his notes, apologizing and drinking. Everyone except him felt that the spectacle was rapidly approaching total disaster, and it was a relief to us all when he sat down and ceased his death struggles. It was one of the most uncomfortable audiences I have ever been in, and he was the most ashamed and humiliated speaker I have ever seen. He had begun without knowing what he was going to say, and had finished without knowing what he had uttered. No sane person would start to build a house without some sort of plan. But why will one begin to deliver a speech without the vaguest kind of outline or program? A speech is a voyage with a purpose, and it must be charted. If you start nowhere, you will generally get there. I wish I could paint this saying of Napoleon's in flaming letters of red a foot high over every doorway on the globe where students of public speaking gather. The art of war is a science in which nothing succeeds which has not been calculated and thought out. That is just as true of speaking as of shooting. But do speakers realize it, or, if they do they always act on it? They do not. Most emphatically, they do not. Many a talk is just a trifle more plan and arrangement than a bowl of Irish stew. What is the best and most effective arrangement for a given set of ideas? To answer this takes careful study. It is always a new problem, an eternal question that every speaker must ask and seek the answer again and again. No infallible rules can be given, but we can, at any rate, illustrate briefly here, with a concrete case, just what we mean by orderly arrangements. How a prize-winning speech was constructed. Here is a speech that was delivered by a student of my course before the 13th Annual Convention of the National Association of Real Estate Boards. It won first prize in competition with 27 other speeches on various cities. This speech is well constructed, full of facts, stated clearly, vividly, interestingly. It has spirit. It marches. It will merit listening and study. Mr. Chairman and friends, back 144 years ago, this great nation, the United States of America, was born in my city of Philadelphia, and so it is quite natural that a city having such an historical record should have that strong American spirit that has not only made it the greatest industrial center in this country, but also one of the largest and most beautiful cities in the whole world. Philadelphia has a population close to 2 million of people, and our city has an area that is equal to the combined size of Milwaukee and Boston, Paris and Berlin, and out of our 130 square miles of territory, we have given up nearly 8,000 acres of our best land for beautiful parks, squares, and boulevards, so that our people would have the proper places for recreation and pleasure, and the right kind of an environment that belongs to every decent American. Philadelphia, friends, is not only a large, clean, and beautiful city, but it is also known everywhere as the great workshop of the world, and the reason it is called the workshop of the world is because we have a vast army of over 400,000 people employed in 9,200 industrial establishments that turn out $100,000 worth of useful commodities every 10 minutes of the working day. And, according to a well-known statistician, there is no city in this country that equals Philadelphia in the production of woolen goods, leather goods, knit goods, textiles, felt hats, hardware, tools, storage batteries, steel ships, and a great many other things. We build a railroad locomotive every 2 hours, day and night, and more than one half the people in this great country ride in streetcars made in the city of Philadelphia. We manufacture 1,000 cigars a minute, and last year, in our 115 hosiery mills, we made 2 pairs of stockings for every man, woman, and child in this country. We make more carpets and rugs than all of Great Britain and Ireland combined, and in fact, our total commercial and industrial business is so stupendous that our bank clearings last year, amounting to $37 billion, would have paid for every Liberty bond in the entire country. But friends, while we are very proud of our wonderful industrial program, and while we are also very proud of being one of the largest medical, art, and educational centers in this country, yet, we feel a still greater pride in the fact that we have more individual homes in the city of Philadelphia than there are in any other city in the whole world. In Philadelphia, we have 397,000 separate homes, and if these homes are placed on 25-foot lots side by side in one single row, that row would reach all the way from Philadelphia, clear through to this convention hall at Kansas City, and then on to Denver, a distance of 1,881 miles. But what I want to call your special attention to is the significance of the fact that tens of thousands of these homes are owned and occupied by the working people of our city. And when a man owns the ground upon which he stands and the roof over his head, he is fully committed to the American way of life. Philadelphia is not a fertile soil for socialism or anarchy, because our homes, our educational institutions, and our gigantic industry have been produced by that true American spirit that was born in our city and is a heritage from our forefathers. Philadelphia is the mother city of this great country and the very fountainhead of American liberty. It is the city where the first American flag was made. It is the city where the first Congress of the United States met. It is the city where the Declaration of Independence was signed. It is the city where that best-loved relic in America, the Liberty Bell, has inspired tens of thousands of our men, women, and children, so that we believe we have a sacred mission, which is not to worship the golden calf, but to spread the American spirit and to keep the fires of freedom burning, so that, with God's permission, the government of Washington, Lincoln, and Theodore Roosevelt may be an inspiration to all humanity. Let us analyze that speech. Let us see how it is constructed, how it gets its effects. In the first place, it has a beginning and an ending. That is a rare virtue, my dear listener, more rare than you may be inclined to think. It starts somewhere. It goes there straight as wild geese on the wing. It doesn't dawdle. It loses no time. It has freshness, individuality. The speaker opens by saying something about his city that the other speakers could not possibly say about theirs. He points out that his city is the birthplace of the entire nation. He states that it is one of the largest and most beautiful cities in the world, but that claim is general, trite. Standing by itself, it would not impress anyone very much. The speaker knew that, so he helped his audience visualize the magnitude of Philadelphia by stating it as an area equal to the combined size of Milwaukee, Boston, Paris, and Berlin. That is definite, concrete. It is interesting. It is surprising. It makes a mark. It drives home the idea better than a whole page of statistics would have done. Next, he declares that Philadelphia is known everywhere as the great workshop of the world. Sounds exaggerated, doesn't it? Like propaganda. Had he proceeded immediately to the next point, no one would have been convinced. But he doesn't. He pauses to enumerate the products in which Philadelphia leads the world. Woolen goods, leather goods, knit goods, textiles, felt hats, hardware, tools, storage batteries, steel ships. Doesn't sound so much like propaganda now, does it? Philadelphia builds a railroad locomotive every 2 hours, day and night, and more than one half the people in this great country ride in streetcars made in the city of Philadelphia. Well, I never knew that, we muse. Perhaps I rode downtown yesterday in one of those streetcars. I'll look tomorrow and see where my town buys its cars. 1,000 cigars every minute, 2 pairs of stockings for every man, woman, and child in this country. We are still more impressed. Maybe my favorite cigar is made in Philadelphia. And these socks I have on? What does the speaker do next? Jump back to the subject of the size of Philadelphia that he covered first, and give us some fact that he forgot then? No, not at all. He sticks to a point until he finishes it, has done with it, and need never to return to it again. For that, we are truly grateful, Mr. Speaker. For what is more confusing and muddling than to have a speaker darting from one thing to another, and back again, as erratic as a bat in the twilight? Yet many a speaker does just that. Instead of covering his points in order, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, he covers them as a football captain calls out signals, 27, 34, 19, 2. No, he is worse than that. He covers them like this, 27, 34, 277, 19, 2, 34, 19. But this speaker, however, steams straight ahead on schedule time. Never idling, never turning back, swerving neither to the right nor the left, like one of those locomotives he has been talking about. But he makes now the weakest point of his entire speech. Philadelphia, he declares, is one of the largest medical, art, and educational centers in this country. He merely announces that, then speeds on to something else, Only 12 words to animate that fact, to make it vivid, to engrave it on the memory. Only 12 words lost, submerged in a sentence containing a total of 65. It doesn't work. Of course not. The human mind does not operate like a string of steel traps. He devotes so little time to this point, is so general, so vague, seems so unimpressed himself, that the effect on the hearer is almost nil. What should he have done? He realized that he could establish this point with the self-same technique that he just employed to establish the fact that Philadelphia is the workshop of the world. He knew that. He also knew that he would have a stopwatch held on him during the contest, that he would have 5 minutes, not a second more. So, he had to slur over this point, or slight others. There are more individual homes in the city of Philadelphia than there are in any other city in the world. How does he make this phrase of his topic impressive and convincing? First, he gives the number, 397,000. Second, he visualizes the number. He says, if these homes were placed on 25-foot lots side by side in one single row, that row would reach all the way from Philadelphia, clear through this convention hall at Kansas City, and then on to Denver, a distance of 1,881 miles. His audience probably forgot the number he gave before he had finished the sentence. But forget that picture? That would have been well nigh impossible. So much for cold material facts. But they are not the stuff out of which eloquence is fashioned. This speaker aspired to build up to a climax, to touch the heart, to stir the feelings. So now, on the home stretch, he deals with emotional material. He tells what the ownership of those homes means to the spirit of the city. He eulogizes Philadelphia as the very fountainhead of American liberty. Liberty. A magic word, a word full of feeling, a sentiment for which millions have laid down their lives. That phrase in itself is good, but it is 1,000 times better when he backs it up with concrete references to historic events and documents, dear, sacred, to the hearts of his hearers. He says, it is the city where the first American flag was made. It is the city where the first Congress of the United States met. It is the city where the Declaration of Independence was signed, Liberty Bell, a sacred mission, to spread the American spirit, to keep the fires of freedom burning, so that, with God's permission, the government of Washington, Lincoln, and Theodore Roosevelt may be an inspiration to all humanity. That is a real climax. So much for the composition of this talk, but admirable as it is from the standpoint of construction, this speech could have come to grief, could easily have been brought to naught, had it been expressed in a calm manner devoid of all spirit and vitality. But the speaker delivered it as he composed it, with a feeling, an enthusiasm, born of deepest sincerity. Small wonder that it won first prize. The way Dr. Conwell planned his speeches. There are not, as I have already said, any infallible rules that will solve the question of the best argument. There are no designs or schemes or charts that will fit all, or even a majority of speeches. Yet here are a few speech plans that will prove usable in some instances. Dr. Russell H. Conwell, the author of the famous Acres of Diamonds, which you will hear in the appendix, once informed me that he had built many of his innumerable speeches on this outline. 1. State your facts. 2. Argue from them. And 3. Appeal for action. Many students of my course have found this plan very helpful and stimulating. 1. Show something that is wrong. 2. Show how to remedy it. And 3. Ask for cooperation. Or, to put it another way, 1. Here is a situation that ought to be remedied. 2. We ought to do so-and-so about the matter. And 3. You ought to help for these reasons. Chapter 15 of this book, entitled How to Get Action, outlines still another speech plan. Briefly, it is this. 1. Secure interested attention. 2. Win confidence. 3. State your facts. Educate people regarding the merits of your proposition. And 4. Appeal to the motives that make men act. Senator Beveridge's method of building a talk. The Honorable Albert J. Beveridge has written a very short and very practical book entitled The Art of Public Speaking. The speaker must be master of his subject, says this noted political campaigner. That means that all the facts must be collected, arranged, studied, digested, not only data on one side, but material on the other side and on every side, all of it. And be sure that they are facts, not mere assumptions or unproved assertions. Take nothing for granted. Therefore, check up and verify every item. This means painstaking research, to be sure, but what of it? Are you not proposing to inform, instruct, and advise your fellow citizens? Are you not setting yourself up as an authority? Having assembled and marshaled the facts of any problem, think out for yourself the solution those facts compel. Thus, your speech will have originality and personal force. It will be vital and compelling. There will be you in it. Then write out your ideas as clearly and logically as you can. In other words, present the facts on both sides, and then present the conclusion that those facts make clear and definite. Woodrow Wilson fits the bones together. I begin, said Woodrow Wilson when asked to explain his methods, with a list of the topics I want to cover, arranging them in my mind in their natural relations. That is, I fit the bones of the thing together. Then I write it out in shorthand. I have always been accustomed to writing in shorthand, finding it a great saver of time. This done, I copy it on my own typewriter, changing phrases, correcting sentences, and adding material as I go along. Theodore Roosevelt prepared his talks in the characteristic Rooseveltian manner. He dug up all the facts, reviewed them, appraised them, determined their findings, arrived at his conclusions, arrived with a feeling of certainty that was unshakable. Then, with a pad of notes before him, he started dictating, and he dictated his speech very rapidly, so that it would have rush and spontaneity and the spirit of life. Then he went over this typewritten copy, revised it, inserted, deleted, filled it with pencil marks, and then dictated it all over again. I never won anything, he said, without hard labor and the exercise of my best judgment and careful planning and working long in advance. Often he called in critics to listen to him as he dictated or read his speech to them. He refused to debate with them the wisdom of what he had said. His mind was already made up on that point, and made up irrevocably. He wanted to be told not what to say, but how to say it. Again and again he went over his typewritten copies, cutting, correcting, improving. That was the speech that the newspapers printed. Of course, he did not memorize it. He spoke extemporaneously. So the talk he actually delivered often differed somewhat from the published and polished one. But the task of dictating and revising was excellent preparation. It made him familiar with his material, with the order of his points. It gave him a smoothness and sureness and polish that he could hardly have obtained in any other fashion. Sir Oliver Lodge, a late 19th century, early 20th century physicist and philosopher, told me that dictating his talks, dictating them rapidly and with substance, dictating them just as if he were actually talking to an audience, he had discovered to be an excellent means of preparation and practice. Many of the students of public speaking courses have found it illuminating to dictate their talks to the dictaphone or tape recorder and then to listen to themselves. Illuminating? Yes. And sometimes disillusioning and chastening also, I fear. It is a most wholesome exercise. I recommend it. This practice of actually writing out what you are going to say will force you to think, to clarify your ideas. It will hook them in your memory. It will reduce your mental wandering to a minimum. It will improve your diction. Ronald Reagan, earned his reputation as a great communicator by his ability to present his ideas effectively and with enthusiasm. He had the added advantage over speakers of earlier generations in that he not only could dictate his talks into a tape recorder and then listen to them, but could videotape them and observe his demeanor and body language before presenting the talk in public. Benjamin Franklin's classic tale. Benjamin Franklin tells in his autobiography how he improved his diction, how he developed readiness in using words, and how he taught himself a method in arranging his thoughts. This story of his life is a literary classic, and unlike most classics, it is easy to read and thoroughly enjoyable. It is almost a model of plain, straightforward English. This is a book that every person interested in self-improvement will enjoy and benefit from reading. I think you will like the selection I referred to. Here it is. About this time, I met an old volume of The Spectator. It was the third. I had never before seen any of them. I bought it, read it over and over, and was much delighted with it. I thought the writing excellent and wished, if possible, to imitate it. With this view, I took some of the papers, and, making short hints of the sentiment in each sentence, laid them by a few days, and then, without looking at the book, tried to complete the papers again, by expressing each hinted sentiment at length, and as fully as it had been expressed before, in any suitable words that should come to hand. Then I compared my Spectator with the original, discovered some of my faults, and corrected them. But I found a stock of words, and a readiness in recollecting and using them, which I thought I should have acquired before that time, if I had gone on making verses. Since the continual occasion for words of the same import, but of different length, to suit the measure, or of different sounds for the rhyme, would have laid me under a constant necessity of searching for variety, and also have tended to fix that variety in my mind, and make me master of it. Therefore, I took some of the tales and turned them back again. I also sometimes jumbled my collections of hints into confusion, and after some weeks endeavored to reduce them into the best order, before I began to form the full sentences and complete the paper. This was to teach me method in the arrangement of thoughts. By comparing my work afterwards with the original, I discovered many faults and amended them. But I sometimes had the pleasure of fancying that, in certain particulars of small import, I had been lucky enough to improve the method of the language. And this encouraged me to think I might possibly, in time, come to be a tolerable English writer, of which I was extremely ambitious. Play solitaire with your notes. You were advised in the last chapter to make notes. Having gotten your various ideas and illustrations down on scraps of paper, play solitaire with them. Toss them into a series of related piles. These main piles ought to represent, approximately, the main points of your talk. Subdivide them into smaller lots. Throw out the chaff until there is nothing but number one wheat left. And even some of the wheat will probably have to be put aside and not used. You ought never to cease this process of revision until the speech has been made. Even then, you are very likely to think of points and improvements and refinements that ought to have been made. Good speakers usually find, when they finish, that there have been four versions of the speech. The one that they prepared, the one that was delivered, the one that the newspaper said was delivered, and the one that they wished on the way home that they had delivered. Shall I use notes while speaking? Although he was an excellent impromptu speaker, Lincoln, after he reached the White House, never made any address, not even an informal talk to his cabinet, until he had carefully put it all down in writing beforehand. Of course, he was obliged to read his inaugural addresses. The exact phraseology of historical state papers of that character is too important to be left to extemporizing. But, back to Illinois, Lincoln never used even notes in his speaking. "They always tend to tire and confuse the listener," he said. "And who of us would contradict him? Don't notes destroy about 50% of your interest in a talk? Don't they prevent, or at least render difficult, a very precious contact and intimacy that ought to exist between the speaker and the audience? Don't they create an air of artificiality? Don't they restrain an audience from feeling that the speaker has the confidence and reserve power that he ought to have? Make notes, I repeat, during the preparation. Elaborate ones. Profuse ones. You may wish to refer to them when you are practicing your talk alone. You may possibly feel more comfortable when you have them stored away in your pocket when you are facing an audience. But, like the hammer and saw and axe in a Pullman coach, they should be emergency tools, only for use in the case of a smash-up, a total wreck, and threatening death and disaster. If you must use notes, make them extremely brief and write them in large letters on an ample sheet of paper. Then, arrive early at the place where you are to speak and hide your notes behind some books on a table. Glance at them when you must, but endeavor to screen your weaknesses from the audience. John Bright used to secrete his notes in his big hat lying on the table before him. However, in spite of all that has been said, there may be times when it is the part of wisdom to use notes. For example, some people during their first few talks are so nervous and self-conscious that they are utterly unable to remember their prepared speeches. The result? They shoot off at a tangent. They forget the material that they so carefully rehearsed. They drift off the high road and flounder about in a morass. Why should not such people hold a few very condensed notes in their hands during their maiden efforts? A child clutches the furniture when it is first attempting to walk, but it does not continue it very long. Do not memorize verbatim. Don't read, and don't attempt to memorize your talk word for word. That consumes time and courts disaster. Yet, in spite of this warning, some of the people listening to these words will try it. If they do, when they stand up to speak, they will be thinking of what? Of their messages? No, they will be attempting to recall their exact phraseology. They will be thinking backwards, not forwards, reversing the usual processes of the human mind. The whole exhibition will be stiff and cold and colorless and inhuman. Do not, I beg of you, waste hours and energy in such futility. When you prepare for a meeting on a serious situation, do you sit down and memorize verbatim what you are going to say? Do you? Of course not. You reflect until you get your main ideas clearly in mind. You may make a few notes and consult some records. You say to yourself, I shall bring out this point and that. I am going to say that a certain thing ought to be done for these reasons. Then, you enumerate the reasons to yourself and illustrate them with concrete cases. Isn't that the way you prepare for the meeting? Why not use the same common sense method in preparing a talk? Grant at Appomattox. When Lee asked Grant to write down the terms of surrender, the leader of the Union forces turned to General Parker, asking for writing material. When I put my pen to paper, Grant records in his memoirs, I did not know the first word I should make use of in writing the terms. I only knew what was in my mind, and I wished to express it clearly, so there could be no mistaking it. General Grant, you did not need to know the first word. You had ideas. You had convictions. You had something that you very much wanted to say, and to say clearly. The result was that your habitual phraseology came tumbling out without conscious effort. The same holds good for everybody. 2,000 years ago, Horace wrote, Seek not for words, seek only fact and thought, and crowding in will come the words unsought. After you have your ideas firmly in mind, then rehearse your talk from beginning to end. Do it silently, mentally, as you walk the street, as you wait for cars and elevators. Get off in a room by yourself and go over it aloud, gesturing, saying it with life and energy. Canon Knox Little of Canterbury used to say a preacher never got the real message out of a sermon until he had preached it half a dozen times. Can you hope then to get the real message out of your talk unless you have at least rehearsed it that many times? As you practice, imagine there is a real audience before you. imagine it so strongly that when there is one, they will seem like an old experience. Why the Farmers Thought Lincoln Awfully Lazy. If you practice your talks in this fashion, you will be faithfully following the examples of many famous speakers. Lloyd George, when he was a member of a debating society in his hometown in Wales, often strolled along the country lanes, talking and gesturing to the trees and fence posts. Lincoln, in his younger days, often walked a round trip of 30 or 40 miles to hear a famous speaker. He came home from these scenes so tired, so determined to be a speaker, that he gathered the other hired workers about him in the fields and, mounting a stump, he made speeches and told them stories. His employers grew angry, declaring that this country orator was awfully lazy, that his jokes and his oratory were ruining the rest of the workers. Herbert Asquith, who later became Britain's prime minister, gained his first facility by becoming an active worker in the Union Debating Society in Oxford. Later, he organized one of his own. Woodrow Wilson learned to speak in a debating society. So did most successful lawyers, politicians, and public speakers. Study the careers of famous speakers and you will find one fact that is true of them all. They practiced. They practiced. And those who make the most rapid progress are those who practice most. Chauncey M. Depew had a fairly active life as a railroad president and a United States senator. Yet, during it all, he made speeches almost every night. "I do not let them interfere with my business," he said. "They were all prepared after I had arrived home from my office late in the afternoon." We all have 3 hours a day that we can do with as we please. That was all Darwin had to work with, as he had poor health. 3 hours out of 24, wisely used, made him famous. Theodore Roosevelt, when he was in the White House, often had an entire forenoon given over to a series of 5-minute interviews. Yet he kept a book by his side to utilize even the few spare seconds that came between his engagements. If you are very busy and pushed for time, read Arnold Bennett's How to Live on 24 Hours a Day. Buy an inexpensive paperback copy and keep it with you to read while you're waiting online, riding in a train or cab, or sitting in some doctor's waiting room. It will show you how to save time, how to get more out of the day. You must have relaxation and a change from your regular work. There are people in this course who meet together an additional night each week for rehearsal. If you cannot do that, play the game of extemporaneous speaking in your own home with your own family. One way to gain speaking experience is to seek places where people are encouraged to speak. One of the participants in my coursework woke up one Sunday morning and shook his wife awake and asked, "Is there any place in New York where I can make a speech today?" She reminded him that anyone could speak at a Quaker meeting if the spirit moved him or her. Somewhere in Brooklyn, he located a Quaker meeting house and was so moved by the spirit that he spoke for 20 minutes. In most cities in the United States, and in some cities throughout the world, there are Toastmasters clubs, informal groups that meet on a regular basis, usually over dinner, where members give brief talks on subjects of interest to them. Men and women from all walks of life join together to share ideas and gain the experience of giving public talks. Look for a Toastmasters club in your area. Join it, and get up there and talk, talk, talk. How Douglas Fairbanks and Mary Pickford entertained themselves. There were no greater movie stars in the 1920s and 30s than Douglas Fairbanks, Mary Pickford, and Charlie Chaplin. Yet, with all their wealth and fame, they were able to find no greater entertainment, no more enjoyable way of spending their evenings, than by practicing extemporaneous speaking. Here is their story as Douglas Fairbanks told it in the American magazine. "One evening we were fooling, and I pretended to introduce Charlie Chaplin at a dinner. He had to rise and make a speech to fit the introduction. And out of that developed a game that we have been playing almost every night for 2 years. We three each write a subject on a slip of paper and fold the slips and shake them up. Each of us draws. No matter what the word is, each of us has to rise and talk for 60 seconds on that word. We never use the same word again. That's what keeps the stunt new. And we use all kinds of words. I remember one evening when two of the words were faith and lampshades. Lampshades fell to me, and I had one of the hardest times I ever had talking for 60 seconds on lampshades. Just try it if you think it is easy. You start out bravely. Lampshades have two uses. They modify and soften the glare of light, and they are decorative. Then you are through, unless you know a lot more about lampshades than I do. I got through somehow. But the point is how all three of us have sharpened up since we began that game. We know a lot more about a variety of miscellaneous subjects. But far better than that, we are learning to assemble our knowledge and thoughts on any topic at a moment's notice and to give it out briefly. We are learning to think on our feet. I say, we are learning because we are still at this game. We haven't tired of it in almost 2 years, which means that it is still making us grow. In a nutshell. 1. The art of war, said Napoleon, is a science in which nothing succeeds which has not been calculated and thought out. That is as true of speaking as of shooting. A talk is a voyage. It must be charted. The speaker, who starts nowhere, usually gets there. 2. No infallible, ironclad rules can be given for the arrangement of ideas and the construction of all talks. Each address presents its own particular problems. 3. The speaker should cover a point thoroughly when it is presented, and then not refer to it again. As an illustration, see the prize-winning address on Philadelphia. There should be no darting from one thing to another, and then back again, as aimlessly as a bat in the twilight. 4. Russell H. Conwell built many of his talks on this plan. A. State your facts. B. Argue from them. And C. Appeal for action. 5. You will probably find this plan very helpful. A. Show something that is wrong. B. Show how to remedy it. And C. Appeal for action. 6. Here is an excellent speech plan, which we will go to in further detail in Chapter 15. A. Secure interested attention. B. Win confidence. C. State your facts. And D. Appeal to the motives that make men act. 7. All the facts on both sides of your subject must be collected, arranged, studied, and digested. Prove them. Be sure they are facts. Then think out for yourself the solution those facts compel. 8. Before speaking, Lincoln thought out his conclusions with mathematical exactness. When he was 40 years of age, and after he had been a member of Congress, he studied Euclid so that he could detect sophistry and demonstrate his conclusions. 9. When Theodore Roosevelt was preparing a speech, he dug up all the facts, appraised them, then dictated his speech very rapidly, corrected the typewritten copy, and finally dictated it all over again. 10. If possible, dictate your talk to a tape recorder and listen to it. Even better, videotape yourself and review not only how you speak, but how you look when you make the talk. 11. Do not read your talk. An audience can hardly be brought to endure listening to a read speech. And 12. After you have thought out and arranged your talk, then practice it silently as you walk along the street. Also, get off somewhere by yourself and go over it from beginning to end, using gestures, letting yourself go. Imagine that you are addressing a real audience. The more of this you do, the more comfortable you will feel when the time comes for you to make your talk. Errors in English. There is no more revealing symbol of education than one style of speech. It will be recognized by discerning men more quickly than a Roman nose or a cauliflower ear. Harry Collins Spillman. Review. There are 5 errors in the following paragraph. See if you can find them. The letters had laid on his desk for several days without answer because he was accustomed to sit there and do nothing. He had rose to the position of superintendent and did not know how to set either himself or his staff to work. As the sun sat in the west, he was still sitting there. New study material. Some of the most commonly misused verbs are given in the following examples. Run over these carefully. You will find that a short drill every now and then, with the first set of examples, will teach you to overcome any irregularities, which you may have had. The second set contains the ordinary wrong uses. Observe these mistakes enough so that you will see your errors, but do not impress the errors on your memory. It's one of the best rules of modern pedagogy that one learns far more rapidly and more efficiently by impressing the right than by observing the wrong. Here are the right examples. He became wealthy. They began to complain. I bade him to come, meaning invited. We were bidden to the party. I bid $5, meaning I made an offer. $5 was bid. The wind blew hard all day. The wind has blown hard. I brought my purse. The purse was brought. They broke down on the road. They have broken down. The pipes have burst. He came home. He has come home. She dived off the bridge. She had dived off the bridge. He did the best he could. He has done the best he could. He drank heavily for years. He has drunk heavily for years. Here are the wrong examples. He become wealthy. They begun to complain. I bid him to come. We were bid to the party. The wind blowed hard all day. The wind has blowed hard. I brung my purse. The purse was brung. They break down on the road. They have broke down. The pipes have busted. He come home. He has came home. She dove off the bridge. She had dove off the bridge. He done the best he could. He has did the best he could. He drunk heavily for years. He has drank heavily for years. Correct usage of words. People are fortunate when they get things by good luck. If they accomplish what they set out to do, they are successful. If they gain the things that most people desire, they are said to be prosperous. Lincoln was fortunate in having a strong, rugged constitution. When he tried to run a grocery store, he was neither successful nor prosperous. Flourishing is derived from a Latin word meaning to bloom and flower. Thriving literally means to grasp for oneself, and carries with it a sense of thriftiness. Try is a very general and comprehensive term. One may try almost anything without much concern about the success of the trial. We generally attempt only those things that we very much want to do. An endeavor is a continuous attempt. One should endeavor to increase each day his knowledge of words. Aim is more general and less specific than attempt. Almost everyone vaguely aims to do many things which he really never attempts or endeavors to do. Strive implies hard, earnest effort or a struggle. As, for example, He had to strive against all kinds of difficulties. To struggle is to use much effort. Voice exercise, relaxation. Probably more voices are ruined by strain, said the famous opera singer, Madame Schumann-Heinck. Then, through any other cause, the singer must relax all the time. This does not mean flabbiness. It does not mean that the singer should collapse before singing. Relaxation, in the singer's sense, is a delicious condition of buoyancy, of lightness, of freedom, of ease, and an entire lack of tightening in any part. When I relax, I feel as though every atom in my body were floating in space. There is not one single little nerve in tension. Madame Schumann-Heinck is referring to singing, but of course, the same facts apply to speaking. Strain ruins voices, she says. Yet what is more common in this hurried age than strain and nervous tension? These things show in the voice as plainly as they show in the face. Relaxation. That should be our watchword. Relaxation. That should be our shibboleth. Relaxation is the secret of good voice. How are we to set about cultivating it? First, learn to relax the whole body. Your entire physical being acts as a sounding board for your voice. The least imperfection in the sounding board of a piano, even a screw loose in the case, will affect the tone. And as your voice is affected by every part of your body, tension here and there will impair its perfect functioning. How can you relax? It's simple. Just relax. That is all. It's not a question of doing anything. It is a question of not doing. It is not effort that is wanted. It is the lack of it. Hold your arm out straight from your shoulder and in front of you. Relax it now. When it fell, did it swing back and forth a few times like a pendulum? If it did not swing at all, you did not relax it. You pulled it down. Try it once more. How was that? Each night when you go to bed, lie on the flat of your back and practice the deep, diaphragmatic breathing that we discussed in the first two chapters. But before you begin your deep breathing, relax. Relax your whole body. Relax thoroughly. Feel as inert as a bag of wool. Try to imagine all the energy that is in your arms, your legs, your neck, is flowing into the center of your body. You ought to be so relaxed that your jaw will fall open. Let your arms and legs and body feel heavy on the bed, so heavy and lifeless that it seems as if you would never have the strength to lift them again. Feel lazy. Now, breathe deeply, slowly, naturally, thinking nothing but ease and relaxation. True, thoughts of the worries, the problems, the anxieties of the day just past and the day to come may swarm through your brain like an army of mosquitoes to pester and annoy you, to keep you taut. If they do, smoke out such thoughts as you would smoke out the mosquitoes. Smoke them out with such soothing declarations as, I am at ease. I'm thoroughly relaxed. I feel as though I hadn't the strength to lift my arm. I'm thoroughly relaxed. That thought and the rhythm of your deep breathing ought to induce drowsiness very quickly, and you'll drift away into a deep sleep. How refreshing, how soothing, how sustaining such a sleep will be. When you have developed the delightful feeling of this kind of relaxation, try to induct more of it into your daily life. And when you speak, try to feel as Madame Schumann-Heinck does when she sings. She says, I feel as though every atom in my body were floating in space. When you can do that, and breathe correctly and control your breath, you are on the high road to good voice production.